I think this is a week that No Nonsense Nutrition needs to comment on the news, because there has certainly been about a lot of news about food. And, you know, one of the very first things that caught my eye this week was the idea that they were ready to diagnose a new attention disorder. And you go, well, Eve, what does diagnosing a new attention disorder have to do with food? Well, with more than 6 million American children having received a diagnosis of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, there's a concern that a lot of these kids are misdiagnosed. And I certainly see that in my practice. You know, I'm glad when I was a kid that they didn't have all these alphabet diagnoses, because I'm sure I would have been diagnosed with LMNOP. But people in the mental health field think that that 6 million number could be vastly expanded with this new diagnosis they're trying to hang on us called sluggish cognitive tempo. Now, we just talked about a band having sizzling tempos, but here we've got somebody that's got sluggish tempo. So this condition, characterized by lethargy and daydreaming and slow mental processing, I know it sounds like your brother-in-law, but what's true is sluggish cognitive tempo is starting to earn some respect as a potential diagnosis, which, of course, they can fix with a pharmacological treatment. You know, when the big pharmas look at a new diagnosis, there's an opportunity for a new drug. So the Journal of Abnormal Child Psychology devoted over 100 pages in its January issue to papers that were describing this, quote, illness. And you're still saying, Eve, why does ADHD and sluggish cognitive tempo have to do with food? Well, I'm here to tell you, the stuff that masks itself as food is what is mucking up the delicate metabolism of the neurons. Daydreaming, mind wandering has given us some of the most creative things that have ever existed in the history of our society. So yes, I do realize that there are children who have tremendous trouble with focus and concentration. I talk about neurotransmitters on a regular basis on this show. And the neurotransmitters, epinephrine and norepinephrine, you may know them as adrenaline and noradrenaline, are very much a part of focus, memory, and concentration. And if somebody starts their day with a bowl of sugar bombs, remember, never eat a cereal that changes the color of your milk. Then we're in a situation where children are not getting the raw materials that are necessary to make these neurotransmitters, because all neurotransmitters, like all hormones and enzymes in the body, are proteins. And in order to make a protein, we have to have the amino acid that are the parts of a protein. You know, if you think about our alphabet, we have 26 letters, but out of those 26 letters in various combinations, we make tens of thousands of words. Your body does the same thing with amino acids. It takes these 20 amino acids and it makes tens of thousands of different proteins out of them, put together in various combinations. So the amino acids that are the pieces of protein, and the only proteins, the only foods that contain all of those amino acids, are the protein foods that come from animals. When we look, whether it walks, crawls, swims, or flies, if it's ever been alive, if it's got a mama, if it's got eyeballs, then it's got all those aminos. If we're talking about the plant kingdom, for the most part, and there are some small exceptions, not all of the aminos are present. That's one of the reasons that we recommend, if you're a vegetarian, that you not only eat grain, but you also eat beans, because the aminos that are low in grain are high in beans, and the aminos that are low in beans are high in grains. So then you're getting all your aminos. But the point we're making here is that some of these kids may have sluggish cognitive tempo. I'm sure it's going to end up being called SCT. Simply because of the fact that they don't get the aminos that are necessary to make epinephrine and norepinephrine. And so their focus, their memory, and their concentration is affected. And remember, this doesn't just happen to kids. It happens to adults as well. So the reason that I recommend that you eat protein within an hour of arising, whether you have your Greek yogurt, whether you have your egg, a salmon burger, a bean burger, you know, the idea is you got to get those aminos in there because the body doesn't store protein. We know absolutely the body stores fat. All you got to do is look out your window and you can see that demonstrated. We know the body stores carbohydrates. We take carbohydrates and we dehydrate them a little bit. We take glucose and we dehydrate it and make glycogen out of it because just like anything you want to store, if you fold up that blanket real tight, it takes up less space than if you wad it up and put it in the shelf. So we take a glucose molecule, take a little bit of water out of the glucose molecule, turn it into glycogen and store it in our liver and the large muscles of our buttocks and our legs mostly, because those are the biggest muscles in our body. So if you take your body weight and you add a zero to it, you approximately have the number of calories that your body stores as carbohydrates. So a 140-pound person would have about 1,400 calories stashed. That way, if you didn't have any food tomorrow, you wouldn't starve to death. So we know we can store fat. We know we can store carbohydrates. But what's true is we can't store protein. You know, that word comes from the Greek. It means of first importance. And we have to get it in there every day, every day, every day. So how am I going from this new attention disorder, SCT, to the food that's in the news? Well, I think that these tasty edibles that are sold that mask themselves as food, these delicious edibles, in fact, aren't food. You know, our neurons, our brain cells aren't just in our brain. They're in our stomach of all places. So when we look at what happens to the body when we eat a plate of food, we don't really know all the things that are going on. You know, nutritional science is a pretty new science, a couple hundred years old. And we want to think that we understand it. But I mean, look at the fight that's already gone on in terms of food. Oh, it's high protein. No, it's low protein. Oh, it's high fat. No, it's low fat. You know, those arguments go on, and we have all sorts of populations to demonstrate that we don't know the answers. You know, go to Africa where the Maasai tribesmen suck on cattle blood. You know, they live on meat and milk. They hardly ever eat any plants. You know, go to Central America, where the high carbohydrate diet of corn and beans are the primary sources of fuel. Go to Greenland. The Inuits largely subsist on seal blubber. Mmm, yum. There isn't a seal blubber restaurant in all of Sarasota. So here's a population that subsists fundamentally on fats, while the Central American Indians subsist largely on corn and beans, and then the Maasai tribesmen fundamentally live on cattle blood, meat, and milk. We don't know. We don't know all of what food does. Now, we can subdivide groups, because we can clearly see that the individuals that eat the so-called Western diet with lots of processed food and meats and lots of added fat and sugar and lots of refined grain and, you know, lots of everything except vegetables have the highest rates of cardiovascular disease, cancers, obesity, type 2 diabetes, things that will make us suffer. You know, we look at half of the top 10 killers in America, and they're all diet-related. You know, a third of cancers absolutely can be related to diet. 80% of cardiovascular disease can be related to diet. We know this by traveling around the world. You know, we go to Japan, where coronary disease affects 7% of the population, while in this country it affects more than 40% of the population, we can see a difference in the diet. So nutritional science has learned some things. They've learned that more plants are more better. Yeah, don't you get your grammar knickers in a wad on that one. but we don't know exactly why. Well, I'm here to submit a new disorder, a new dietary disorder. A dietary disorder that just says the further away from nature your food is, the more problems you're going to have. You know, when Michael Pollan said, make sure your great-grandmother could recognize the food, well, I didn't have the good fortune to ever know a great-grandmother. But the idea is that food should be food. I've said many times here on No Nonsense Nutrition that there's a big difference between a potato and a Pringle. There's a big difference between a chicken and a chicken nugget. There's even a big difference between a fresh orange off the tree and a glass of orange juice. But as we look at the news this week, and we see that the same kind of plasticizer, something that's used to harden plastics, to firm plastics, was found in the bread at the Subway Corporation. And not just at Subway. There were 500 different foods that were found to contain these yoga mat compounds. Azodicarbonamide. Oh, it just rolls off the tongue. Remember when Grandma was in the backyard in the azodicarbonamide harvest with her little basket, picking those little fresh azos? Of course I'm being sarcastic. But it doesn't matter whether you were eating Pillsbury dinner rolls at Thanksgiving or having a Little Debbie product or eating any one of the 100 sandwiches that you ate this year on Wonder Bread. What's true is that this compound, well, the focus got put on Subway, but that, you know, in some ways just focused the inquiry because, once again, it's in 500 different products that are out there. Now, why in heaven's name would somebody put a plasticizer into bread? Well, remember what the food industry is trying to do. The food industry is trying to make food immortal. You know, if you ever want to know whether it's food or not, just ask one question. Does it rot? If it doesn't go bad, it's not food. It's as simple as that. When you take that box of crackers that's in your pantry right now and it sits there for a year, you can will it to your grandkids because it's never going to go bad, then we're at a place now that we can't call it food. Well, you know, you say, well, I'm going to make a loaf of bread. You get yourself one of them fancy bread machines. You know, somebody gives it to you for Mother's Day, so you have something else to store. And you take flour and water and yeast and sugar. And you put the yeast and dissolve it in a little warm water. You don't want it hot. You don't want to kill the yeast. And then you put a spoonful of sugar in there. And the reason you put the spoonful of sugar in there is the yeast have to have something to eat. The only way the yeasts are going to multiply is they have something to eat. And so now we've mixed that little bit of sugar in with that yeast, and then we put our flour in there. And then we mix it up, and then we take that ball, and we leave it alone in the bottom of the bowl, and we put it in a warm place and cover it with a damp towel. And 3 hours later, we go back, and that yeast has caused that ball of dough to triple or quadruple or even more in size. And I remember my mother did what she called punching it down, which is when you push the air back out of that ball of dough. And then you put the wet towel on it, stick it on top of the refrigerator again for a couple of hours, and it rises a second time. And then she would put it in a bread pan and stick it in the oven. And that was all that it had in it. But when I read the ingredients that were in the Subway bread, it turned out that it was enriched flour, which is wheat flour with malted barley flour, and it contains those nutrients that the federal government says you have to put back, the niacin, the iron, the B1, the B2, thiamine and riboflavin and folic acid, because you take it out when you mill the flour. So enriched wheat flour actually has a number of ingredients: wheat flour, malted barley flour, and these B vitamins. It contains yeast. It contains whole wheat flour. Now remember, these have to be put in the order of volume, so there's less whole wheat flour than yeast. Sugar, wheat gluten, oat fiber, soybean oil, wheat bran, salt, wheat, rye, yellow corn, oats, triticale, that's half wheat, half rye, brown rice, barley, flaxseed, millet, sorghum, yeast nutrients, vitamin D2, dough conditioners. And the dough conditioners, there's five of them: DATEM, whatever the hey that is, sodium stearyl, lactylate, potassium iodate, ascorbic acid, and there's our old friend, azodicarbonamide. Then a little caramel color, some refinery syrup, some honey, another yeast extract, natural flavor, and enzymes. Those are the ingredients in Subway's nine-grain bread. Now, what's really interesting about that is that if you go to the United Kingdom, if you go to Britain, to England, and you go into a Subway there, their list of ingredients in their bread is different than it is in the United States. In the United Kingdom, it's wheat, flour, water, sugar, yeast, bran, hydrogenated vegetable oil, salt, emulsifiers, several of these dough conditioners, as it were, that I already listed. And guar gum is a thickener and a little bit of ascorbic acid, which is vitamin C. You know, we go from 30 ingredients down to a dozen for a bread that's made for the very same company in a different country where there are not only different regulations, but different tolerance of these things. Well, when we look at the petition that was created against Subway, and by the way, to Subway's credit, they are going to remove it from the food. And there are several other companies that have come forward to say the same thing. But what we find out is that factory workers that work in companies where they make this azodicarbonamide have asthma and other respiratory issues. Now, do we know if that's going to happen if you're just eating one sandwich a month? And the answer is, of course not. We don't know that. Who's going to pay to study that? You know, the business of interpreting toxicity is a pretty tricky business. But what happens is that when this compound, azodicarbonamide, breaks down, it breaks down into semi-carbazide and urethane. And that breaks down during the baking process. So are these things toxicologically significant? Well, let's go back to that kid. Let's go back to that kid that was just diagnosed with sluggish cognitive tempo and ask whether we have mucked up the delicate metabolism that is taking place on his brain neurons. Remember, you and I are made of chemicals, and a whole lot of people say, that's all, we're all just made of chemicals, so it doesn't matter what the chemicals are. Well, chemicals are made of molecules, and molecules are made of atoms, and you have a billion, billion, billion atoms in your body. And if you don't think that the body has learned how to tell a natural from an unnatural compound after 200,000 years of evolution of the Homo sapiens species, well, then think again. You know, toxicology is based on dose. You know, even water can be a poison. You drink too much of it. So too much, too little of all sorts of compounds can be problems. So are these tiny concentrations that are going to happen in a sandwich enough that we can call them toxicologically significant? Well, add them up. Add them up to the other 60,000 chemicals that are in the American food supply. You know, something has to change. It's no shock to find out that Americans are remarkably unhealthy eaters. We eat too much cheese. We eat too much sugar. We eat too much starch. And up until this week, we used to eat too much red meat. Now, that's about to change since beef just went to its highest price since 1987. Yeah, averaging $5.28 a pound. It's up just since January of this year. We have less total cows, and we have a huge big demand from China and Japan for our beef. And so what's true is people are going to eat less beef just simply because of the fact that there's going to be less available. So it's a law of supply and demand. So, yeah, we can reduce the amount of beef in the diet and therefore reduce the amount of colon cancer and prostate cancer, which have clearly been linked to high amounts of red meat. And what you're going to see is some restaurants are going to raise their prices, and some restaurants are going to serve a 6-ounce sirloin instead of an 8 or a 10-ounce portion that they served years ago. And as far as I'm concerned, that's a good deal. They're going to put additives into the burger meat. And so, you know, in some ways, having those high prices on beef is actually going to be an advantage. But our eating habits are poor, in part because of the fact that corporations are trying to change food with fat, with sugar, with salt, with preservatives, and with flavoring agents to make you want more and to jazz up low-quality raw materials, low-quality ingredients. So if you take really low-quality ingredients and you put a lot of sugar, salt, and fat in it, you can make them deliciously yummy. And so the very idea of making something deliciously yummy so that you will eat more of it. You know, when you begin to investigate what's going on in commercial food, you learn right away that if it's advertised on television, you probably shouldn't put it in your mouth. Because if it's advertised on television, it ain't food. Now, there's an exception. I mean, the almond people came in, and the beef people came in, and the walnut people came in, and the prune people came in. And so, you know, there were some times that it actually were identifying and promoting a real food. But, you know, sit with a notepad in your lap tonight and tick off how many food ads are for really non-food items. These delicious high fat, and especially saturated fat, and especially hydrogenated or trans fats, even though we are getting hip to that. So guess what the brain is made out of? The brain is fundamentally fat. You're a fathead. I'm a fathead. Well, if the fats that you eat are fats that don't occur in nature, nowhere in nature do they occur, and we take them into our body, what does our body do with them? You think we just poop them out? Well, that'd be real convenient. But in fact, they become a part of the cell membrane. They become a part of your brain. And so we're wondering why this child is sitting in a desk and they can't think. Well, maybe what we've done is to plasticize their neurons. Maybe what we've done is we've changed the fat in their brain into something that doesn't transmit messages anymore. Or it certainly doesn't transmit them accurately. So, you know, it's deeply satisfying to me to find that phrase that Michael Pollan gave wings to, eat food, not too much, and mostly plants. 7 words, real magic, brilliant journalism. Eat food. Right, food. And you say, well, Eve, what else would you eat? If you read the ingredient label on a container of Cool Whip, I dare you to find the food. You know, when you're eating things you can't pronounce, we've made jokes about that. You know, when I have something that I can hand to a third grader and a third grader can't pronounce it, we're in trouble. If you don't have it on your shelf, if you wouldn't cook with it, if you don't have it in your pantry, ethoxylated diglycerides, cellulose, xanthan gum, calcium propionate, ammonium sulfate, If you wouldn't cook with them yourself, then why let others use these ingredients to cook for you? So it tells you right away that if you want to be healthier, you want to have at least a leg up on being healthier. Why am I interested in being healthy? Because it reduces pain and it improves function. It's real simple. What does ill health do? It takes away your choices. It takes away your choices. If you want to go somewhere this afternoon and you can't go there because your knees hurt too bad, you can't walk around, you can't go there because you have diarrhea and you got to make sure that you're close to a bathroom, you can't go there because your head hurts, you can't go there because you don't feel good, you don't have the energy. I remember one time, very many, many years ago, in Bernard Jensen's class, and my tip of my hat to Bernard Jensen, who awakened very many ideas for me about the relationship of food and health. And he said, go to all those ladies that are sitting in their rocking chairs in the front of the nursing homes and the old age homes, the ones that fed their husband to death. And I went, ooh, that's kind of a cruel thing to say. And he said, oh, they gave him that extra piece of pie. You know, they made them their favorite dish. And they dug their graves with their fork. You know, ask any of those ladies, would they have changed what they put on the table if it would have brought back their life partner? And he says, and I'll bet most of them would say yes. So Bernard Jensen's example was a way to awaken me to the message getting through that we're eating in a way that's killing us. Something has to change. And it falls on our back. It doesn't fall on the back of the government. It doesn't fall on the back of the food manufacturers. You know, if it's a plant, eat it. If it's made in a plant, don't eat it. But when we look at people that are in low-income areas, we even see a worse situation because oftentimes these are food deserts. You know, those ma-and-pa convenience stores that are often in low-income areas are selling chips and soda and candy at the front of the store. But perishable goods like fruits and vegetables are more expensive and they come at a risk of not being sold. So, you know, a convenience store won't buy 12 apples at a time. But, you know, you put Twinkies on the shelf, they'll last forever. So it's even worse in a low-income area. And we know that the nutrition that a growing child receives, especially before the age of 5, makes a huge big difference in how their brain works for the rest of their life. So, yeah, we are making some changes. Yeah, we're eating some more yogurt. And we're having some more chicken. We're eating less beef. And we're eating less sugar. And as a result of the show that I did a couple of weeks ago, probably we're eating less pizza, because I've certainly had a lot of comments about that show. We need less white flour in our diet. It doesn't matter whether it's a bagel for breakfast or a sandwich for lunch or pretzels in the afternoon or pasta for dinner or cookies before we go to bed. So fruit and vegetable consumption is up, but it's still depressingly low. Yeah, we're starting to drink a little less soda. You know, sales of Diet Coke and Diet Pepsi were down 7% last year. You know, I cheer when I hear stuff like that. You know, when we look at the proposes to the nutrition facts on the label, the nature of changing those nutrition facts so that we can distinguish the grams of sugar that are added from the grams of sugar that are in the food. I talk to people about the difference between plain yogurt and vanilla yogurt. And they go, well, I don't like plain yogurt. But it still has sugar in it. No, that's the sugar that occurs naturally in milk. But then there's the added sugar. And so if you look on the label of plain yogurt, it's the new nutrition facts label is going to say X amount of sugar, depending on the size of the delivery, but zero in added sugars. But when you look at the vanilla yogurt, it's going to say X amount of sugar that occurs naturally in the milk, and then the amount of added sugar that's there. So that's something new that's going to show up on the nutrition label. The serving sizes are going to reflect something that is more accurate, and that means larger. You know, you get a 20-ounce bottle of soda pop, and it has 2.5 servings in it. But people look, and the same thing is true with the iced tea. You buy the iced tea in the 20-ounce, and you look on the back of it, and it tells you how many calories are in there, but you don't realize that's for 2.5 servings. So the serving size amounts are more accurately reflected in the new Nutrition Facts label. The calories and the servings per container, those lines are going to be bigger and bolder, so you can actually read them. So there is going to be a change, but just like Newt Gingrich, you know, the famous nutritionist, he called it symbolic liberalism. You know, they always got to come out with one, don't they? But when we realize that there is way too much sugar in the American diet, anybody who's reading that label and it, you know, makes them think twice about having more sugar, then it's worth it. But if you look at the size that America is getting, you realize a whole lot of people aren't reading the nutrition facts. You know, Dr. Lustig, the doc from University of California in San Francisco, he's an endocrinologist. He wrote the book Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar. Actually, he's got a YouTube video called Sugar, the Bitter Truth that's probably 5 years old now, but it's something worth viewing to make you aware of all of the hidden sugar and how it's affecting us. So here we got plasticizers in the food, and yeah, we got hidden sugar in the food. And we're getting a backlash from people who are finally realizing that all this low-fat, no-fat, you know, if it says low-fat or no-fat, the best thing to do is no way. But a lot of people are biting back against this low-calorie food because it makes people feel deprived. It was interesting when they did the experiment where they took a milkshake and they declared that one milkshake was full fat and the other milkshake was low fat, even though they were exactly the same. And then people drank the two and wrote down their perceptions. So just believing that something was full fat made it more delicious. Just believing something was low fat made it less satisfying. So when we look at the backlash that's happening in terms of these low-fat, no-fat foods, we're seeing a falling. You know, we're seeing lean cuisine drop 27% in its sales. And so what they did is they replaced it with something called Honestly Good. Nestle's is paying attention. They put 400 calories in those servings instead of 300 calories so people didn't feel deprived. What's the problem? They're still genetically modified organisms that are in there. And you go, GMOs? GMOs are in the food? Oh, yeah, GMOs are in a lot of your food. In fact, I can bet you right now that if you stood on the scale and you were a typical American adult who weighs 179 pounds, you would be shocked to find out that you're eating more than your body weight in genetically engineered food every year already. Even just with the few genetically engineered foods that are out there in the marketplace. You know, most notably corn and corn-based sweeteners, sugar, and corn products, and soybeans. You know, all I've ever asked for is the right to know. Just let me know what's in my food so that I can pick. But, you know, I travel a good bit. And so I eat in restaurants. When you're on the road, there's only so much of your own food that you can carry with you. So when I go into a restaurant and I get my healthy salad and I put my salad dressing on it, Almost 80% of the salad oil that's consumed in the United States is soybean oil. And since 93% of all the soybeans that were grown in the United States in 2013 are genetically engineered, then I'm getting genetically engineered soybean oil in my salad dressing. You know, if I pick up a packet of sugar and I put it in my cup of tea, since more than 50% of all the sugar comes from sugar beets, it doesn't come from sugar cane. And since 95% of all the sugar beets that are grown in the United States are genetically engineered, it's likely that I'm getting genetically engineered sugar. If I go out to have a corn tostada, a burrito, anything that's on that corn tortilla, the highest likelihood is that corn, if it's grown in the United States, is genetically engineered. 88% of all the corn grown in the United States last year was genetically engineered. So those numbers are actually going up. You know, I'm not going to be surprised at the point that it's 100% of soybeans and 100% of sugar beets and 100% of the corn. They're even experimenting now with using popcorn, you know, the corn that's used to make the corn tortillas and the corn starch and the high fructose corn syrup isn't the same particular species of corn that's used to make popcorn. But popcorn is one of the things that's on the list. But, you know, I love caramel corn. Caramel corn is one of my treats. But I go to grab that bag of caramel corn and I think, okay, I got genetically engineered sugar put on genetically engineered corn. Yeah, I think I'm going to pass. So even though these crops are the primary crops that are genetically engineered separate from cotton, which of course we don't eat, but there are 30 other crops that are being tested in field trials now for genetic engineering, from apples to bell peppers to carrots to cherries to coffee to grapefruit to lentils to lettuce. I mean, name it. They are the 30 most eaten plants that we have in this country, all the way to sweet potatoes and tomatoes. So when they went back and weighed it all up, environmental working group analyzed this, and they analyzed how much genetically engineered plants are being grown and how much are being used, and they said that the average American was eating just shy of 200 pounds of genetically engineered food. I go to a restaurant and I order two eggs for breakfast and I put ketchup on it. That ketchup has got genetically engineered corn syrup in it, high fructose corn syrup. So little bits, even for those of us that are trying to be awake, trying to be alert, trying to be able to make the choice. And so, you know, all I've asked for is just let me have a right to know. Let me have the right to know if there's genetically engineered food, and then let me choose. But Mike Pompeo doesn't think so. Mike Pompeo, you probably haven't heard that name. He's one of our congressional representatives. He's a Kansas Republican that's decided that he would introduce legislation to block any federal or state action requiring the labeling of foods made with genetically engineered ingredients. Now, 90% of Americans support the labeling of genetically engineered foods. It's clear that the public wants to know what's in their food. But if Representative Pompeo has his way, nobody's going to have that right. You know, 8 out of 10 American families buy something organically. They want to know what's in their food. But Representative Pompeo wants to sign away the rights of all Americans. His bill, and this is this week, I mean, this is hot off the presses, was christened the Deny Americans the Right to Know, or the DARK Act. Genetic engineering labeling laws have gained support over the last couple of years. Even though Proposition failed in California, it's on the ballot for this year for a number of states. But his proposal would prevent states from making it illegal for food companies to label products containing genetically engineered ingredients as natural. It would forbid the states from making it illegal. Connecticut's already done that. Connecticut, along with Maine, passed a law requiring genetic engineer labels. 30 states are taking up legislation about genetically engineered labeling this year. But that doesn't go far enough for Representative Pompeo, Republican of Kansas. He wants to limit the authority of the Food and Drug Administration to compel companies to disclose genetically engineered ingredients. This bill is identical to legislation that was floated earlier this year by the food industry's main lobbying arm, the Grocery Manufacturers Association. They want a veil of secrecy around ingredients so people don't know what's in their food. If you live in Saudi Arabia, you can know whether you have genetically modified ingredients in your food. If you live in China, you have the right to know. In 62 other countries, consumers have the right to know. Why shouldn't Americans have the same right? Well, gee, do you think Republican Representative Pompeo is getting any money from these organizations? Agribusiness has given him hundreds of thousands of dollars. The Center for Responsive Politics found out that the Koch brothers and the Koch industry gave him $238,000. Now, these billionaires, Charles and David Koch, you know, are known for their extensive support of conservative causes. But that's the top individual contributor. What's true is that he's received money from other organizations that are lobbyists or worker bees for the grocery manufacturing trade group. You know, when President Obama made a campaign promise back in 2007 to label foods made with genetically engineered ingredients known, we're not saying they're bad. We're just saying there's no evidence telling us that they're good. And all we're saying is we just want the right to choose. Genetically engineered food may turn out to be good. They said it was going to feed the world's hungry. That hasn't happened. They said the use of Roundup Ready soybeans was going to reduce the use of pesticides. Actually, the use of pesticides has increased since we've used genetically engineered soybeans. So what's a consumer to do in the meantime? Well, not much unless you demand that genetically engineered food be labeled. And then at least you can choose. And then the other thing is to buy things that don't have a label. Broccoli doesn't have a label. A chicken doesn't have a label. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't gnarly things in that broccoli or in that chicken. The chicken could still be fed arsenic-laced food, which is used to stop parasites in the chicken. Yeah, 74% of all the chicken feed that has been approved for use in the by the FDA in the United States has arsenic in it. Again, it's just a little bit. Like the azo dicarbonamide. It's just a little bit. Just a little bit of all kinds of things. So we don't know that GMO foods aren't safe. We just don't know that they're safe. So give me the chance to choose. And when I choose, the more things I choose that don't have an ingredient label on them, or if they have ingredients, there's no more than five ingredients. You know, Baskin-Robbins got on that bandwagon and, you know, they have five ingredient ice cream. Well, great, but it's still ice cream. Yeah, having a treat is a treat. Enjoy the heck out of it when you have it. But it shouldn't be a mainstay in your diet. And so when we look at labels that say 100% organic, it's the only way that we can avoid GMOs in the diet. Because it doesn't matter whether it's canola oil or corn flour. It doesn't matter whether it's cottonseed oil or dextrin or dextrose made from corn. You reduce corn starch down to sugar, it becomes dextrose. Remember, if it ends in an OSE, it's a sugar. Now, you may easily avoid things that are called glycerol monooleate. You may avoid things that have a funky name that you don't recognize, like azo dicarbonamide. But, you know, you see something like malt or milk powder or modified starch. It just seems real benign. You know, all the vegetarians out there that are sucking down tofu to beat the band need to understand that it's almost impossible to find tofu that isn't containing genetically engineered ingredients, not just the soy. You know, soy protein isolate, soy sauce, soy oil, soy milk, soy lecithin, soy isolate, soy flour, genetically engineered. So when you buy food that looks like food, what did I have for breakfast? I had pineapple and strawberries and papaya with my Greek yogurt. You know this. I mean, 8.5 years that I've been on the air, I've told you what I eat for breakfast. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, it's fruit and Greek yogurt. And Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, it's vegetables and eggs. Right. And Sunday, it's both of them. I have the fruit first, and then I have the eggs at lunch. That's pretty much it for me. Yesterday, it was sautéed onions with 2 poached eggs on top. Yum. Delicious. But those are foods that occur in nature. You know, are we eating foods that occur in nature? Are we eating food? Get out of the supermarket. Go to the farmer's market. Remember, the average food in America travels 1,500 miles. Did you see the UN report on climate change? We got to stop transporting this food 1,500 miles. You know, if you look at that ingredient and you can't picture it in the ground, you can't picture modified food starch growing. You know, if you look at textured vegetable protein and go, have I ever seen a textured vegetable protein tree? Have I ever seen a textured vegetable protein bush? Have I ever seen a textured vegetable protein well? You know, these are your clues. Just like eating foods that go bad. You know, I was cleaning some of those strawberries this morning. Some of them were all gooshy and, you know, had soft spots in them. They go bad. They rot. That means they're food. If you're going to shop in the grocery store, just shop the outside aisles. That's where the food is. So whether it's the dairy or the meat or the fruits and vegetables, that's where it is. You go up and down those middle aisles. There's no food there. You know, when we look at foods that make health claims, you know, this one helps your heart. I talked about that on the show 2 weeks ago. The very one that was labeled to help your heart is the one that had iron filings in it. Yeah, it said reduced iron on the label. And some real smart guy took that cereal, saturated it with water, turned it into a mush, and put a magnet through it and got iron filings. Little bits of ground up iron. Out of the cereal. Reduced iron. That's an improved ingredient. And on the front of the box, it said heart healthy. Remember margarine? One of the very first industrial foods that claimed that it was more helpful. Turned out it contained trans fats that gave people heart attacks. So you were supposed to go to margarine because it was better than butter. And actually, it created more heart attacks than having had the saturated fat in the first place. When we look at foods that make health claims, danger. Danger, run. When you avoid high fructose corn syrup, when you avoid soybean oil, when you avoid things that you absolutely know that no human would keep in their pantry, you definitely have a step up. And remember, if it arrived through your car window, it's not really food.